He was the original Australian Idol. His three albums so far, Just As I Am, Beautiful Life and Closer to the Sun, have all gone platinum or multi-platinum. Now, as he gets set to release his latest album, Guy Sebastian has found his groove. While his mates were listening to New Kids on the Block and Pearl Jam, Guy was playing classic soul hits from the likes of Otis Redding, Al Green and Wilson Pickett. On the Memphis album, Guy has put his own stamp on the soul music he loves so much. It's my great pleasure to welcome Guy Sebastian to 98.5 Sunshine FM.
How are you, mate?
I'm very well, and you've just flown in. It's a tough schedule for you.
Yes, it always is. This is like that the time in the artist's life where you walk around like a zombie. You just zonked the whole time, but it's good. You got to do it. Look, I just finished a tour, and then had the Arias on Sunday, and headed on this little promo trip. I was in Melbourne yesterday, and then now in sunny Perth. It's a beautiful day, and I just got off the plane. but it's good. I think I gain a couple of hours, so I should get.
Well, that's the way to look at it. Of course, when I looked at the track listing for this new album that you've got coming out, the Memphis album, I thought we're not going to have enough time to play every track on it because they all look like they're absolute stunners. Yeah. It's an impressive bunch of songs, isn't it?
It really is, and all coming out from Memphis, you know, and I grew up on this stuff. It was actually, there was a 50-year anniversary of soul music in Memphis, and there was this press release that went out, and I had a look at all the songs, and I couldn't believe that they were all from Memphis. And so me and a couple of other guys, we all had this little idea to put together this album, and it came off well. And, you know, I put the dream out there of, oh, wouldn't it be great to get the original guys to actually, you know, who actually wrote the songs and who were the backing band for it, which was Booker T and the MGs. You know, wouldn't it be great to get them on the album? And we sort of put it out there. We approached them, we asked them, they were like, oh, look, you know, we don't really do this anymore and we don't really have time. So, you know, and so then we were quite persistent. We sent them sent them some live stuff of me singing. Titus, my manager, did. And then Steve came back on the phone. He was like, oh, I'm really into this guy's voice. Let's do it. We're all here for the 50th anniversary, blah, blah, blah. And it just happened. It's been one of those things where everything's just fallen into place. I went over, we recorded it 4 days. We did 15 tracks, all old school in the same room on analog tape. It was just unreal. And then we just became really close friends. Like, we'd go and jam every night. And one night we went to B.B. King's Blues Bar, me and the MGs, you know, Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn. And we got up and we had this jam, and then Sheryl Crow gets up on stage. And, like, it was just a really, really cool experience, the whole thing. And Yeah, I loved it.
I guess when you're talking about people like Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn, a lot of people will know them for their soul music over the years and playing with Booker T and the MGs and Green Onions and all those great tracks that they played.
Yeah. And the Blues Brothers.
But a lot of people know them for the Blues Brothers.
Yes, they definitely do. Look, that was a big movie, and people loved that, you know, that whole thing. And I actually hadn't seen the whole movie, and funnily enough, I'm on the way to Memphis, and I look at, you know, the movies that are playing on the plane, and Blues Brothers was one of them. So I quickly tuned in, and then I met Steve. He looked a bit different from then, but yeah, he's a great bloke. We met firstly at this place called Texas de Brazil, which is just a classic Memphis barbecue restaurant. Like, everything's barbecued in Memphis. You're gonna have barbecue ribs if you're in Memphis. They're amazing. But you will end up having them for every meal, breakfast, lunch and dinner.
But even something like opening the album with Soul Man, just incredible. Yeah. And I know that even the Blues Brothers, they did a version of Soul Man, and you can tell that there's this real excitement in when it gets to the guitar solo saying, play it, Steve.
Play it, Steve, yeah.
And knowing that it's the guy who played on the original Sam and Dave track, and you got to do the same thing.
I did, yeah. It was yeah, it was really cool. I mean, just to be able to say that and it be Steve, you know, like, it was a real treat. But, you know, I grew up on that. Wilson Pickett, Al Green, you know, Sam and Dave, Staple Singers. I grew up on that stuff, and I was just, you know, I'm blessed to be able to lend my voice to those songs. They're great songs. I've got, you know, Knock on Wood, Midnight Hour, Sitting at the Dock of the Bay, all of which Steve wrote. I've got Soul Man, Under the Boardwalk, What else? Hold On, I'm Coming. Yeah, so many great songs on the record, and sounds pretty cool having them play.
And when there are so many great soul classics over the years, how did you get to narrow it down to the set list? I mean, there's quite a number of tracks on the album, but how did you narrow it down to just those?
I think I just narrowed down to the ones that I knew really well, like the ones that I knew, that I know and love. This is like my favourite Memphis songs, and there's so many others that are, you know, everyone else's favourites as well, but they're probably the most popular ones that are out from Memphis. I'm sure there's other ones which were as popular, but can only fit 14 or so on a CD. So I'm pumped for those songs. They're great songs.
And you say that you struck up a really good friendship with the guys there. So any plans of perhaps doing something in the future with them?
Well, they're actually coming down in March to be my backing band for my tour, which will just be it's kind of music history here, like having them back. They haven't been here for 30 years. Mm-hmm. So they were pumped. They were like, "Oh, I remember Australia. That was awesome. It was a great time. You guys got barbecue ribs out there, you know." And I was like, "Well, if you want to find out, you can come and tour with me." And I think by then, you know, we'd hung out for sort of 2 weeks straight, and we just struck up a friendship. And Steve, it was just the stories. Like, Steve told me great stories. Like, you know, they all had these amazing stories about Otis Redding and just all, you know, even Elvis. Like, Steve used to tell me all these stories when he hung out with Elvis, and so it was just a really cool experience. Like, they told me how their original drummer was murdered, and no one actually knows all this sort of stuff, so it was really cool to get this, like, unpublished info that no one knows, and straight from the horse's mouth, you know. And I'm pretty stoked that they're going to be my backing band. Like, it's crazy. Like,
you have to pinch yourself to realize that this is true.
I think it's just been one of those things. Like, it just there was a hand on it, and it just kind of flowed. Like, from the idea to Steve saying yes to me getting it through, and Sony were amazing. Like, my Sony BMG, the record label, just jumped on it and made stuff happen. And I was over in Memphis before I knew it, recorded the album, you know, got the album mixed by a guy called Steve Greenwell, who everyone was like, "I can't believe you got Steve Greenwell to mix it for the price you got him at." And, you know, like, because Steve heard it and he's like, "Yeah, I'd love to do this." And, he's an amazing engineer. He mixed Josh Stone's stuff and a few others, like heaps of others. And so it all kind of just worked. And then the tour now, like, to have them coming out for the tour, stuff doesn't just happen that easily with the MDs. Like, it was something, you know, I had some help, I think.
And when can people expect to find that in the shops?
In a couple of weeks, I think. 10th of November.
Okay.
Oh, that's early. I thought it was actually the end of November.
I've already been having calls from people saying, "I want to know where I can get the album." From hearing the first half of the song, I had someone calling and saying, "I've got to grab that." So it must be pleasing when people have that immediate response when they start to hear that music.
Oh, look, I think it's got little to do with me and a lot to do with the musicians and the songs. You know, the songs themselves are just such classics that transcend, you know, through time. And I was just lucky enough to be able to lend my voice to it. You know, these guys, they've heard everyone from Otis Redding, you know, Al Green, the finest singers. Mm. and they've played them and backed them and toured with them, and so it was a treat to be able to just have, you know, be in the same presence as these guys.
Now, let's go way back to your rise to fame on Idol. It didn't only bring positive attention. How did you deal with going from being someone who was almost unknown, just known to your friends and your family, to then having complete strangers feeling that they had the right to comment publicly about your private life? Must have been tough.
It was a strange transition, because I don't remember the transition. It kind of just flicked overnight. Like, it was, I don't remember actually processing the change in my life. Like, I just ended up kind of going, "Oh, this is my life now. And like, but I never even had that thought. It kind of just happened. And suddenly there was, like, during Idol, it was pretty crazy. We had people out the front of our house. They'd camp out the front. They'd rock up at 4 a.m. and just wait there before school to see when we were going out. And there was signs. They all made signs. And even my parents back home in Adelaide, they had people who would just wait outside the house. And, like, it was really, really strange. And you know, before then, I was just living in Adelaide. I studied at uni and I was working, and suddenly from that to shoot into, you know, this life so quickly, it was just kind of, you know, I didn't have time to think about it. I just sort of made the transition quickly and that was it. Like, and since then, I don't think I've thought about it. It's just who I am and who I was called to be. And so I love it. I wouldn't change it for anything. It's the best life. You know, it's, my hobby is my job and you know, it's a dream. That's everyone's dream, I think. Yeah, I've got a lot of people to thank for that and I'll never take it for granted. Like, I finish my hobby, which is meant to be my work, and then I go home and do more of my hobby, which is more music, you know, and so it's like I get to do my hobby all the time. It's great.
Do you think it's easier being involved in the first season of Australian Idol, where you were, and I guess not being so much of an expectation there, to now, where some of those people in Idol, they know a bit of what to expect? What was easier? Was it sort of shaping what Idol was to become, or do you reckon that they've got it easier now, sort of with a bit of a feel for what might happen along the way?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've probably got it harder now, to be honest. Like, like, for us, I had no idea what Idol was. Like, I'd never heard of it. I didn't know what it entailed. Like, I thought it was like another pop stars type show. I was thinking the whole time, oh man, I hope they don't get us to do choreography and, you know, like, because I'm really unco and you know, like, I'm a singer. Like, I'm a soul singer. I'm not a pop star in that way, you know. And so I thought, there's no way I'm going to get through this. And then I ended up, you know, I ended up going all the way to the end, and I never thought that I'd get there. But Idol ended up being something which was totally different to what I expected it to be. And you know, we were all along for the ride. Like, I don't think we took it as serious as maybe the following years took it, because they knew what was at stake. We had no idea. Neither did Sony BMG, or neither did you know, the people who own Idol didn't even bother getting in on the management here in Australia. Like, they didn't even bother kind of setting up their own management, because they thought, oh, it's Australia. No, they won't sell any records. It won't succeed. It'll, you know, it'll just be a small little thing. And you know, it ended up being what it was, and it kind of captured the nation. And Shannon had such a, you know, a whole different you know, group of people that he appealed to, and then I was so different to Shannon as well, and so we kind of covered you know, very different sort of groups of people, and but then, you know, the next years, people are like, you know, there's that pressure of you know, we know what this platform can create, and so I think that the kids go in there with a little bit more pressure, to be honest, and probably go there thinking they need to be calculated.
Yeah.
And so, especially this year, I found the kids almost are a little calculated. Like, they're trying to think about what they need to do during the show to set up what they think they're going to have after the show. And I think because of that, they're almost being a bit too cool for school, you know, like, they're not giving it all on the show because they're afraid of, you know, they want to set up who they want to be for after. And so, you know, like Dicko said the other night, apparently I didn't hear it, but he said, you know, kids, you're going to get, you know, it's like that you guys are the kids who are getting bullied in the big bad world. Like, I know a couple of the kids I saw at the Arias, and they were really disheartened, really discouraged. And I remember when I went to the Arias, you know, the first time was actually really cool because no one knew anything about it. And I don't think the industry had really kind of because no one had sold records or anything yet, and the industry hadn't really barked up about it yet, but it was the second year. It was like a really tough time for me going to the Arias, and you know, there was that whole stigma that is attached to any reality TV sort of thing, and you know, people generally can see through it. People can see when there's real talent, there's real talent, you know, and whether it comes from, you know, Dicko said it well. I think he said, you know, kids are getting signed off YouTube and MySpace and all sorts of things. Like, these guys better step up to the mark and not feel too sorry for themselves, because, you know, they deserve to be there, and you deserve a break. And it doesn't matter, you know, at the end of the day. I've had people who've come through radio competitions and got their deal, like, slam me in the media saying, oh, he hasn't worked, or he hasn't done the hard yards, and or you know, he just went on TV and got his deal. And really, there's no difference between a radio competition. Like, that was the platform that got them their deal. TV, you know, fortunately, was the platform that got me my deal, and TV's powerful. You know, you can appeal to a whole, you know,
well, yeah, people talk about the fact that, you know, you guys haven't done your apprenticeship, but watching you go through all that live on television week after week, that's a pretty tough apprenticeship.
Yeah, but for me, that was like the shortest time of, you know, sowing into my talent that I've ever done. Like, prior to Idol, I was in a Christian band, and we toured the States. I toured everywhere. I used to sing, even just singing at church. Like, you sing... like, I'd sing at youth on a Friday night, and then you'd have, you know, church Sunday morning, Sunday night. So you're like, you know, you're singing four different services, you're rehearsing during the week. Then I was in a couple of pop bands, so I was doing, you know, gigs here and there, and like, I gigged a lot. You don't get on stage and suddenly be good, you know? Like, no. It takes a lot of, like, groundwork, and fortunately... at church, you know, you receive this amazing, you know, training, because you're in front of people, and it's, you know, it's, you're singing from your soul, and it's good because it teaches you that music needs to be a little selfless as well. Like, you at church, for me, the weirdest thing about Idol was, at church I'd sung for years, and, you know, it's free, you sing for free, and it's not about you, you know, you're just on stage, and you're a vessel. You're just, you know, it's not about you. It's about the people, and about leading them to a place. And suddenly on Idol, and in the secular market, like, people are paying you, and it's about, it is about you having to entertain them. And so that was kind of a weird headspace to you know, make the transition into. But but it was good fun.
And as well as, of course, that training that you got through church, faith must have kept you grounded through all the things that you've gone through over the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, faith and friends and my upbringing, you know, my parents were great. And I think with faith, the biggest thing that comes with that is the accountability and the realization that your actions, you know, are seen, and they're, you know, like any idol or artist or actor or, you know, anyone who's in the in a public profile, you don't choose to be a role model. You already are a role model, and it's whether you choose to be a good one or you know, someone who doesn't necessarily have a positive impact on young lives. And for me, having done youth work and stuff, it made me realise that kids really need some positivity out there, and none of us are ever going to be perfect, but I think we all need to keep in mind that, you know, as artists, our actions are watched, and people do look up to you, and you got to do everything you can to kind of, yeah.
Guy, it's been great having you here. I know you've got a huge schedule and you've got to rush off, but before you go, the album's coming out soon. You mentioned you're touring. Is that March? You're coming over to Perth with that band?
Yes, I am. I am coming over, which will be pretty cool. I'm pretty sure we've booked a venue in Perth, and... yeah, I've got to get over. I've got to bring the MGs to Perth. That'll be unreal. They'll probably complain about the flight, because, you know, flying 6 hours in the States, you can go from, you know, New York to LA. But yeah, they'll love it. They love Australia, mate. They
really, we'll look after them.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Guy, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for spending some time with us. Thanks.
You.
Bye.